do anything without my committee administrator, so forgive me until she gets here. We're helpless without staff, to their credit. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2401A.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2401A is, this just came back from the floor, and it establishes the early retirement for 911 operators. You have in front of you a dash A2 amendment, which restores bracketed language on section 2, subsection 2, which is on page 2, lines 19 through 20. The effect of restoring the language is to prevent early retirement for all PERS members.
Which I wouldn't have had any problem with. But. Okay, folks, we've had this bill. Are there any questions or discussion?
No.
Representative Holy?
Mr. Chair, I'm just going to move we adopt the A2 amendments to House Bill 2401.
Representative Holy moves the A2 amendments to House Bill 2401. Is there any discussion? Mm-hmm. Seeing none, Kristen, please.
Representative
Brenner.
Aye.
Representative Brenner.
Aye.
Excuse.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Very good. Representative Holby, would you like to take that back to the floor?
Certainly. Do we have to move it?
Oh, excuse me.
Yeah.
Yes, we do.
Yes.
You know, ahead of time, I would gladly entertain
a motion.
If, in fact, we do pass it. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2401. As amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative moves House Bill 2401 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
No, just to put on the record that then it would be the B in gross version. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that clarification. I'm going to wait for Representative Esquivel and see if he wants to vote on the amendment.
Objections?
There were no objections.
He gets to vote on the bill.
I don't know. Oh, there were no objections. That's right. Forgive me. All right. There's been a motion to move 2401 as amended to the floor to be passed recommendation. What we'll do is restore one line. If it had been deleted, we would have allowed all PERS members to retire early.
That's the problem.
Well, we just fixed it. So, without further discussion, Kristen, please.
Aye.
Aye. Representative Holby, now would you like to carry that again?
Yeah.
Thank you very much. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2401A. Open a work session on House Bill 2168.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2168. We've first heard this measure on February 19th. It modifies the fee for a temporary sales license issued by the Oregon Liquor Control Commission to a flat fee of $50 per day. It also requires that the applicants of a temporary sales license submit a plan which details how minors are prevented from gaining access to alcoholic beverages. You have in front of you, committee members, a -1 amendment which adds an additional provision which allows a temporary sales license to be issued to a nonprofit trade association whose membership is primarily comprised of persons that hold winery licenses or grower sales privilege licenses.
Great. I'm going to ask the department to come up and explain this. And Mr. Conklin, if you would like to come and add your two bits to this too, please. And then when we're done, just stay there and we'll go right to the next bill too, please.
Chair Schaffler, members of the committee. I was out of the room and just came in as the chair and did that. Shall I explain the -1 amendment? All right. The sub 8, which is the amendment.
Who is this witness? Do we know?
I'm sorry. Judith Brisanovich, Oregon Liquor Control Commission. The amendment would create a narrow exception to the Quiet House laws, which don't allow a manufacturer or wholesaler to have any interest in a retail license. So it creates a narrow exception for a nonprofit trade association composed of winery or grower sales licensee, which are people who grow the grapes, for example, under their control, made into the wine, and that's exclusive, as an association to obtain a TSL license, which is a very short-term license. And it's considered a retail license, and so that's the problem that's being addressed with this amendment. It allows them to get this short-term license as an association to hold like a special event. Oregon wineries can do that under their winery license, but not as an association. And so it's really a matter of fairness.
And members, we're going to pass the amendment out right now. And it's not the LC's fault that you did not gotten it yet. It was, I returned to my office and my diligent staff put it in my bill file. So that's why you're getting it now. So the blame is all on me.
Shame.
Way to go.
Your staff put copies for everyone?
Yes, Mr. Chair, yes, all the members have to have copies.
Good. Thank you very much. Gary, you want to add to this?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Gary Conkling, representing the Oregon Wine Growers. I think explanation is adequate that we had asked for this amendment. This committee gave its indulgence in waiting to move House Bill 2168. The agency's been very kind and worked with us on the amendment, so we're very pleased.
Thank you. So any questions?
All right. Do we have a referral then?
No.
Okay. Well, if there are none, I will entertain a motion, please.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 Amendment to House Bill 2168.
Representative Holby moves the Dash 1 Amendment to House Bill 2168. Is there discussion? And is there any objection? All right, so then seeing none. Representative Holby.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2168 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Holby moves House Bill 2168 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none. Kristen, please.
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Would anyone like to volunteer to carry this?
I'll carry it.
Thank you, Representative Edwards. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2168 and open the work session on House Bill 2171. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Judith Personovic, Drug and Liquor Control Commission. The substantive Dash 1 amendments, many of them are just technical and substituting words like manufacturer and whatnot, and I'll explain why. The real substantive amendments are one, it limits the quantity that can be directly shipped to consumers to two cases per month, which is the current limit under the reciprocal law that Oregon has, 229. So it limits the quantity, and it adds, originally 2171 only allowed manufacturers of wine and cider to ship, and the quantity was unlimited. You recall there were a couple different bills, but 2171, unlimited quantity, and only the manufacturers of wine or cider. The what's been added are grower sales privilege, which it's a very small number, and it's people who grow the fruit or the grapes that then exclusively go into this particular wine, and they are then allowed to distribute it. And retailers were not included in the original 2171, and that was because the quantities were unlimited, and there were various problems associated with that. With it at two cases per month, which is currently allowed, and retailers are currently allowed to do that under the reciprocal law, so they've been added. But again, the quantity for everyone is limited to two cases per month directly to consumers. And the last addition are nonprofit trade associations that hold a temporary sales license, the subject of the bill that was just 2168 that we just talked about, and only for the period of that temporary sales license, which is a very short period of time, could they could have like an event, and then customers could place their order during that event, and they could directly ship only that, as long as that TSO was valid. Those are primary substantive amendments. It imposes a bond requirement of $1,000 on out-of-state licensees that qualify in-state that matter already have a bond requirement. The other amendments are really more technical, eliminating a monthly reporting requirement to refer more generally to as required in 473. People who aren't, or wineries, for example, that aren't currently subject to a privilege tax in this year and don't expect to be the following year only have to report annually. So it just allows the exemptions that currently exist, if that's the case. And
Mr. Chair,
yes,
I'm sorry, I'm confused. What other amendments? I only have.
I wanted you to clarify that too. That
I only have a Dash 1 amendment.
Yeah.
There only are Dash 1
that's
amendments.
That's right. The
I apologize. I was going through the specific sections.
Oh,
that's
right. No, there's just one set of amendments.
Thank you.
I was just trying to explain the ones that were substantive.
There's only one amendment. You're talking about the specifics of the one amendment.
Correct.
Thank you very much. I was going to ask her to clarify.
My apologies.
No, quite all right. Anything else?
Yeah. Can I ask a question?
Yes. Go ahead, Representative Burton.
If she's done, I have questions.
Are you finished?
Just about. The same thing is true on the taxes. It refers to 473 rather than taxes on everything shipped. And that's because there's a small producer exemption that exists in 473 that might well be qualified for here. And requires that records be made available within the state upon request. Those are the main ones.
Mr. Conklin, anything to add here?
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Again, Gary Conkling representing the Oregon Wine Growers. Just to remind you, we had at a hearing two bills that basically sought to achieve the same thing, which is to respond to the Granholm decision and move us from a reciprocal state on direct shipment of wine to customers to a permit state. This compromise that you see reflects the industry's willingness and eagerness to make sure that we're preserving the agency's ability to enforce and regulate direct shipment. And those provisions were pretty much in House Bill 2171, which was the bill that the agency itself introduced, and that's why the amendment is built inside their bill. The key parts for us were the eligibility to provide direct shipment under current law. In addition to wineries, our companion people, our vineyard operators who do custom crushes and produce wine under their own label without having their own winery. Those people are known as the grower sales privilege licensees, have the privilege of direct shipment today, and under this amendment they would continue to have it. Retailers today have that privilege under this bill, they would continue to have it. And by extension, trade associations that are made up primarily of Oregon wineries or our vineyard operators who make their own wine would be able to have direct shipment when they have a temporary sales license. Those were important things for us, and the agency accommodated our interest in the context of a two-case limit per month to resident, which is current, what the current law is. So after all said and done, what you really have is what I think all of us intended at the very beginning, a shift from a form that the U.S. Supreme Court said was probably a non-constitutional form, the reciprocal state agreement, to a permit state arrangement that provides for equal treatment for in-state and out-state, out-of-state people involving direct shipment under fair parallel rules. With also proper enforcement and appropriate enforcement by the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. I think the Dash 1 amendment does that. And again, I want to thank the agency for its willingness to work with us on this bill.
Thank you. I'd like to remind everybody to shut your phones off or your pagers so you don't go do-do-do on the system here. Any questions?
I think I got them answered.
Very good. Any questions? Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. I'd entertain a motion to adopt the Dash 1 amendment. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the appendage Dash 1 amendments to the bill, 2171.
Representative Esquivel moves the Dash 1 amendments be adopted in House Bill 2171. 2171, is there any discussion? Is there any objection? All right, very good. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that we recommend that we move 2171A as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Very good. Representative Esquivel moves House Bill 2171 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Kristen, please.
Representative
Frederick.
Aye.
Representative
Frederick. Aye.
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 Aye. Would anyone like to carry this bill on the floor?
I'd be happy to.
Representative Berger, thank you very much.
Wine bill.
Work session on House Bill 2171. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2537.
Mr. Chair, committee members, we first heard House Bill 2537 on March 19th. It prohibits employers of mass transit districts, transportation districts, and municipal bus systems from striking or recognizing the picket line of a labor organization while performing official duties. In your packets today are dash 2 and dash 3 amendments. The proponents of the bill would like to have the committee consider only the dash 3 amendment, as that's the amendment agreed upon by all the stakeholders. It is identical to the dash 1 amendment that was heard at the first hearing, and which creates a new statute as versus the current version of the measure, which adds a provision to our ORS 243-736, and it also adds an emergency clause effective on passage.
Thank you. Would one of the Mr. Marquis or both like to come up and briefly explain what we're doing here?
Same
please.
Thing we did on 1-1 and the first.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Jim Marquis, today representing the Amalgamated Transit Union. As we stated during the hearing on this, 2537 would prohibit transit workers from striking, and then they would use binding arbitration to...
Jim, I think somebody has their phone on. I want all of you to check your phones, because if they're on, I want you to shut them off.
What do you got? It was holding.
No, mine's off.
All right, Jim, go ahead. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 2537 would prohibit transit workers from striking, and they would then use binding arbitration to resolve those labor disputes. We fully discussed that in the hearing. The dash 3 amendments, there was some, and by the way, for those that don't know, that arbitration would be a last best offer type of arbitration as opposed to what others might consider. So I want to get that on the record. The amendments, because the original bill added transit workers to 243.736, then those workers would have been affected by Senate Bill 400 provisions. And then they should Senate Bill 400 become law, then they would come under that. There was concern about that, and frankly, that was not the thrust of this legislation to start with. And so we went to council and worked with TriMet and others on language that adds these employees in a separate section of Chapter 243. As additional employees that are prohibited from striking, but would, because they're not under 736, would not be affected by the provisions of Senate Bill 400, and therefore would not have the right to bargain, mandatory bargaining for safety and staffing levels. So, with that amendment, TriMet, I believe, testified that they were neutral on this bill. The amendments further add the emergency clause to the bill, which would obviously make it take effect upon passage, and we feel that's important because the one strike that we have encountered was in Lane County, and that contract is up before the bill would otherwise take effect. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions of Mr. Marquis here today? All right, well, thank you very much. I'll entertain a motion to adopt the Dash 3 amendment.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Rosenbaum.
I move the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2537.
Representative Rosenbaum moves to adopt the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2537. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Very good. Representative Rosenbaum.
Mr. Chair, do we need to move the Dash 2 amendments? Or?
No.
Okay. I move House Bill 2537 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Rosenbaum moves House Bill 2537 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Very good. Kristen, please.
Aye.
I think that's the first mistake Kristen's made all year.
Whose phone was on?
Representative Rosenbaum, would you like to carry this bill?
I would be happy to.
Thank you very much. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2537. I'm going to jump way down the calendar here and open a hearing on Senate Bill 645A.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 645A allows local governments to enact ordinances prohibiting the unauthorized appropriation of a shopping cart from a business premise and to provide for salvaging an abandoned shopping cart. It passed unanimously out of the Senate Business, Transportation, Workforce Development Committee, and also out of the Senate with a 27-2 vote. The committee members, you have in front of you a dash A2 amendment, which replaces the bill in regards to one additional provision for policies that the local governments follow, and also allows governments to enact policies relating to shopping carts, but does not preclude a local government from enacting policies that are similar but not in compliance to what's in the bill.
Thank you. And we have the pleasure of having our former House colleague who went to the other side of the world to work.
I know. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Senator Lori Mona Sanderson from the Gresham Trotwood Village Fairview area, and I'm delighted to be here. It's so nice to be amongst House members. I find that Senate Bill 645 an interesting bill. I'm now known as a sharpened cart lady, but the city councilor from Gresham came to me and said that there is a real issue and they wanted to try to take care of it in the city of Gresham, and that was shopping carts, because it is a blight and a nuisance for many people in the various neighborhoods, and the neighborhood associations were really quite concerned about it. And then the Northwest Grocery Association came to me and said that they had this bill that they would like to introduce regarding abandoned shopping carts. And I said, oh, the stars are aligned. And so then I had a rental, and I went to my rental and to collect the rent, and there were two shopping carts on my property there at the rental. So I figured that this was a bill that I needed to sponsor. But basically what it does, it sets parameters for adopting local shopping cart ordinances, but it doesn't require the local governments to adopt the shopping cart ordinances. But rather than having all of these different local jurisdictions having all of these different ways of collecting shopping carts, if there was a standard, and especially since the grocery association said that they would pay for it and have an 800 number that someone could call to report a shopping cart, and on each shopping cart would be a signage that would indicate the number to call in, and then it would be up to each local jurisdiction to see how they would want to enforce it. It's a very simple bill, but I think a good bill, and especially since the grocers are the ones that would really want it, and they're actually asking for it. And that's really all I had to say, and I'd love to have the Grocery Association come up and give you more details on it.
Thank you, Senator. I'm glad you brought this. They're all over my district, and Johnson Creek cuts my district in half, and they're in the creek a lot of the times,
yes,
too, so hopefully we'll keep them where they belong. Representative Berger.
Before you let the Senator go, and welcome back to the House side.
Yeah.
Are you aware of the Dash 2 amendments?
No, and the Grocery Association said it was a small fix, and so I will wait to hear the testimony,
okay,
but
you.
I shouldn't have a problem with it.
Okay, thank you.
And I spoke to the League of Oregon Cities just today. They said they're okay with this amendment, too.
Thank you.
Any further questions of the good senator here? All right, thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right, I'm going to call Dan Floyd and Kate Tarter, please.
I'll go back to committee if that's all right.
That's quite all right. Keep up the good work. Absolutely, Senator.
I just want you to know that I got emails from all over the world on this bill. I was actually on NPR. And then I had requests from various states saying, what are you doing? This is such a problem. We want a copy of your legislation. And then I had people from Japan and then someone from France telling me how we should do it. We should require a $2 deposit for each shopping cart. I mean, there were all these innovative ideas. So I must say that Oregon did get some notoriety on this bill.
Thank you.
Thank you for this opportunity to speak today. This, how I got involved with this.
Excuse me, miss. You have to identify yourself.
Okay, sorry. My name is Kate Tarter, and I live in Salem. And how I got involved with this is I, at the time, was the chair of the Neighborhood Association, and we do roundup, do cleanup days, and I organize those with a lot of volunteers. But at the end of the cleanup day, we could give all the trash to the Parks Department to haul off, but we didn't know what to do with the shopping carts. And so I hosted a bill or a meeting in Salem with the transit called Solutions for Shopping Carts, and we got an overwhelming response from the community and had to close the meeting because so many people wanted to attend to complain about it. So at that time, I met members from the Grocers Association, and as a result of that meeting, the city of Salem also had formed a committee for solutions on abandoned shopping carts, and it also went to our city council. I was very in support of what the Grocers Association was doing because they attended those meetings with us. What this bill would allow for us or myself as a community volunteer would be that I don't have to deal with the individual managers by calling each individual store. I only have to call one number. I think it's a great solution for the shopping carts that are everywhere, and it's good for businesses because it's consistent and you're asking for the same thing of all business owners. So I think it's a wonderful bill and good situation for people who are out there picking up trash and trying to make the community better.
Well, I just want to thank you for your efforts. I think you're an example of what a difference a person can make if they try and do something positive around here. So I think I can speak for the committee for thanking you personally for your efforts. So appreciate it. Mr. Floyd, go ahead, please.
Dan Floyd, representing the Northwest Grocery Association, here in support of Senate Bill 645. If you don't mind, I'll go through the bill and then address the amendment for when Representative Berger comes back. We lose 3,500 carts a week in the Salem and the Portland metropolitan area. So as far west as Hillsboro and going as far east as Troutdale. So a lot of those 3,500 carts, they leave the store property. A lot of them come back, and we have services right now. Some of us have a cart retrieval service. Some retailers have a neighbor. Some retailers just send out an employee, but it's not coordinated, and the job's not getting done, obviously. So there's still plenty of carts out there right now. Those carts are worth anywhere between $100 and $300. So the carts that don't come back to the retail establishment end up in the neighborhoods, they end up on parking strips, apartment complexes, bus stops. So our goal is to get, you know, this property that's valuable to us off the parking strips, out of the neighborhoods, and back to our retailers so the consumers can use the shopping carts. The plan is simple. A lot of you guys have already heard about it. But we're going to provide a 24-hour toll-free number, and we're also working on providing a website. So it's pretty accessible. There's going to be signage on the car corrals around the stores and around the parking lots. The signage will have, it'll reference a general theft statute. So we're not trying to create a crime, but we do need a deterrent to let that customer know that it is illegal to take that shopping cart without authorization. So we're not attempting to go out and pound on these people taking shopping carts, but we do need the deterrent. On the shopping cart, that same statute will be on there. The name of the shopping cart will be on there. And then the toll-free number. And like I said, if we were able to get that website up where it's accessible via email or the website, that will be there as well. From that point, once a neighbor, a citizen, reports that shopping cart abandoned, we will have 72 hours to retrieve that cart and get it off the streets. And then, if we fail to do our job at that point, which I really hope we don't, and I don't think we will, this bill would allow the cities that adopt this ordinance to assess a fine of $50 to that retailer. So there is a hammer right there to get those retailers involved in this program. And this, and one last point I want to make, is this sets the parameters, and like Senator Moss Anderson said, this isn't a statewide mandate, but it does set the parameters that we think work, that are workable for the neighborhood associations, for the cities, and for all the grocers. So I gave you a small stack of paper there. I want to direct you to the support from the city of Beaverton, and then from Northwest Cart Retrieval. John Kirk from Northwest Cart Retrieval submitted a letter for testimony. for the record. And he is the expert out there, and what he's saying is that a thorough, efficient system like this is going to help us get the carts off the streets and back to the retailers. Finally, the amendments. The amendments would allow the city to adopt a separate ordinance if there are retailers out there who are not taking part in this program, are not in compliance, and just refuse to do their job. So if they're not doing their part, the city has the ability to adopt a separate ordinance. We would hope that that most retailers, we know at least all the grocers at this point, are going to be in compliance with these parameters, and we'll be able to get those shopping carts off the streets and back to us. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan. You were just referring to the dash A2 amendment.
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right. Any questions, Representative Berger?
Mr. Chair, the dash A2, this is of staff, basically replaces the bill, correct?
Dan, you want to speak to that?
Chair Schaffler.
Sure looks like it.
What's that? Chair Schaffler, Representative Berger. Section 1. Line 8 through 15 is where you'll see the amendment. And it does allow the city to adopt something separate, but that's only if the retailer is not in compliance with these parameters. So if they do not have the signs on the carts, if they do not have the 1-800 number service, if they do not have the signs around the parking lot, if they are not currently participating in cart retrieval services, that would allow the city to adopt a separate ordinance. But if you're if the retailers are following these guidelines set forth in the bill, then we won't have to get to that point.
Well, my able staff tells me.
Yeah, these 2-1-2-22-23. Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, it's identical to the engross measure except for the two changes.
Thank you.
Other than
that's
identical.
That's what I'm saying. Thank you. So if I want to read. Don't even.
Oh,
yep.
Here we are.
Got it.
Okay. All righty. Any further, Representative Holvey?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Floyd, I think the chair commented that the League of Oregon Cities were okay with this bill, and you know I noticed that you said there's no mandate to the cities in this bill, and I assume that it's the grocery association or somebody, or it doesn't really specify who's providing the toll-free number and operating the toll-free number, but I'd like to know if there are any plans of who's going to operate that toll-free number. And then it also requires a reporting to local government and of abandoned shopping carts. And so there's going to be some sort of local government involvement in this program. And I guess how are they going to pay for that local participation?
And just for the record, I don't speak for the League of Oregon Cities. I spoke to one of the representatives, two of them, outside in the hall today, and they're not here. But I don't speak for them. That's what they told me. That's secondhand hearsay, just for the record. Dan, you want to respond to Representative Holby?
Chair Schaffler, Representative Holby. I don't speak for the league as well, but I had the same conversation and these other amendments. But as far as the reporting requirement is concerned, first of all, I guess the 1-800 number. We're going to own a 1-800 number, and all the grocers will be involved. Any other retailer who wants to be a part of that 1-800 number will be involved. I've seen how it works. You call in 24 hours. There's a web page in front of you that instructs the operator what to do. At the time that the cart is reported abandoned, they can send an email immediately to the retrieval service, to the retailer, and to the city or county, whoever adopts the local ordinance. So that's the city would know immediately that a shopping cart is abandoned. So the clock would they would know when to start that 72-hour clock immediately. And as far as city involvement, I believe there would be very little city involvement. I know that some cities were concerned about having to go out and actually store a cart, but they would have the same access to cart retrieval services that we do. So it's simple for them to call a cart retrieval service and have them just retrieve that cart. They can send a fine directly to that retailer. So there's very little city involvement.
Representative Smith.
I just had a quick question, and maybe you can answer this. It says on page 3, line 24, local government may take title to a shopping cart. How do you take title to a shopping cart?
Representative Shoffler, or Chair Shoffler, Representative Smith. I believe what it's saying, it's giving the city the ability to take that shopping cart and store it and wait for that, wait for the retailer to pay the fine if the city chooses to do so. I highly doubt the city is going to want to do that. I believe they're going to want to call the cart retrieval service, maybe have their own contract and have them go pick up that cart. I've talked to numerous cities and they do not want to be storing shopping carts. They want their hands off. They like that the private sector and the retailers are going to do this and they can just adopt the ordinance.
Any further questions?
Well, I have lots
Representative
of questions.
Smith. Oh,
thank you, Chair Shoffler. Okay, it says they can dispose of them after 30 days, so where would they store them? And
Chair Shoffler.
I mean, I think you're shifting the blight from the neighborhood to the rivers control.
Chair Shoffler, Representative Smith. If a retailer refuses to pick up a cart and it's there beyond 30 days, then the city does not have to give that cart back. They can choose to dispose of that cart at that point.
Any further questions? Does the committee feel comfortable moving this bill today, or would you like to talk about it more?
I'm fine with it.
All right. I'm going to thank you very much. I appreciate your efforts here. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 645A. Open a work session on House Bill 645A. And we need to move the dash A2 amendments. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the A2 amendments to 645, Senate Bill 645.
Representative Esquivel adopts that we moves that we adopt the A2 amendments to Senate Bill 645A. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? All right, very good. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that we recommend Senate Bill 645. A as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Esquivel moves that we send Senate Bill 645A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Berger.
Well, you know, it's not a bad thing to be known as the shopping cart state, I guess.
He's going to be known as a shopping cart man after he carries it on the floor.
I thought. There was a lot of ducking on moving that. Thank you, Mr.
All right, any further discussion? Seeing none, Kristen, please.
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Representative Esquivel, would you like the honor? Thank you very much. I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 645A. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill... I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3406.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 3406 requires local police and sheriff departments to adopt a policy for all officers regarding wearing a uniform while being off duty.
All right. Thank you very much. Mr. Galashman, please.
Not here.
Well, let's go find him then. Thank you, Kristen. Or thank you, Teresa. Come on up, Brian. God,
I can't believe it. Sorry, I get summoned outside by a senator.
Has nothing to do with this bill. Brian, go ahead.
We're on 3406, number two.
For the record, Brian DeLashman, representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations. I know I heard this term a little while ago. This is a simple bill, but I'll use it as well. This is a simple bill. How many of you have had your picture? I have a picture in your office with a police chief or a sheriff. I would venture to say that all of you, either in an election or on a sheriff or chief's day at the Capitol, have had a picture taken with the chief or sheriff, and they're in uniform.
What a handsome
handsome guy.
Oh. You mean the sheriff?
He's not here to defend himself.
For those that are out there, I'm showing pictures of the chair with a couple of the chiefs.
He's not here.
Now, how many of you have had a picture with a police officer or firefighter from your district? This time I would venture to say that none of you had that picture. You may have one of an officer in straight clothes or in a union polo shirt, but not in uniform. Why is this? Because local jurisdictions consider the uniform the property of the jurisdiction and will not allow officers to have pictures taken while in uniform or appear in the Capitol in uniform.
Good.
Seems to me and the people I represent that we have a double standard when it comes to the use of uniforms. Is not the uniform of the chief or the sheriff the property of the jurisdiction as well? This bill neither outlaws nor endorses the use of uniforms in these cases. Simply, it asks that the jurisdiction have a consistent policy that includes top-to-bottom officers, rookies, the chiefs, or sheriffs. Each jurisdiction can decide no uniforms in these cases. Uniforms when it relates to ballot measures, that could be a local ballot measure, or ballot measures and endorsements of candidates by an association, as well as appearing in the Capitol on behalf of the local or statewide association. And that's a very important distinction. I'm not talking about the officer using the uniform to endorse their own individual candidacy. I'm talking specifically about an association endorsement, and I'll get back to that in just a minute. During the past couple of weeks, I have seen chiefs and sheriffs from West Lynn, Lake Oswego, Portland, Douglas County, Multnomah County, Linn County, along with senior staff from the City of Portland and others in uniform and testifying on behalf of their statewide associations, not their local jurisdictions. We believe that this issue is an issue of fairness. Fair is fair, and with that, I'll answer any questions. Well, let me do the one additional clarification. What typically happens, and it could be applying to the Oregon Council of Police Associations, and I want to make it really clear, this is not a D or an R issue. It really is not. We do our endorsements, and we get a call. I get the call from the candidate and says, I've been endorsed by your association. Can I get a picture taken? And I say, let me check. So I call the officers from Tigard or Portland or whatever and say, the local candidate's been endorsed by either your local association or by my statewide association, would like to have a picture taken with you. And they say, let me check. So then they check with their chief or their sheriff, and the response is very consistent. The uniform is the property of the jurisdiction. So no, the answer is no. But I have seen examples in which there is a local ballot measure or is a statewide ballot measure in which the chief or the sheriff or their associations have an interest in defeating or supporting that ballot measure, and the answer is consistently, sure. So what we'd like to have done, very simply, is just say each jurisdiction has to have a policy on this, and it needs to be uniform, excuse the term uniform, but from the top to the bottom, and that's it. And I would answer any questions.
Before you get going on questions, Ms. Botkin, would you like to come up and testify as well? Did you get some pictures?
And yeah. You were out of the room, and they said, what
no,
handsome people.
Hey, you know what? I don't know who those guys in the uniform. I can't speak about them, but that fellow with them, I wonder if he's as smart as he is good-looking.
Funny, I was commenting on the sheriffs themselves.
Those handsome devils, too. All right, Mary, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I want to come up and support this bill. We've even had some of our jurisdictions go one step further, and that is if we agree with their bill or if they agree with our bill, then we can appear in uniform. And if we don't agree or if they don't agree with our bill, we can't. And it has been very interesting over the years to watch the differences in the enforcement of the uniform issue. Based on whoever the director is or whoever the chief is at the time. When Fred Peirce was our sheriff, he let our people appear regularly in uniform because he appeared in uniform. I agree with Brian. We need some consistency. And it's very intimidating to have people come down here and oppose your bill in regalia that they wear once a year and not allow our people to come in their uniform to support a bill. I mean, it makes no sense. And I agree with Brian. This is not a D or an R issue. This is just fair is fair. Everybody gets treated the same.
I agree with you. Any questions of these fine people? Representative Berger.
Yeah. Why did you write this bill to say that nobody in public safety or fire in the state of Oregon who normally wears a uniform is allowed to wear that uniform in any lobbying or political photographs? I mean, why'd you go this way? Why didn't you go the other way? You guys aren't persuading me that uniforms are that it matters that much, but maybe it's because I'm not impressed when somebody's wearing a uniform. I understand what you're saying, but I mean, the other answer to this is say zero, no uniforms, thank you very much. Nobody can use them for any political, can wear them in any political, can come down here and lobby in them. That would be the bill I'd sign on to. If this is such an issue, which I'm not persuaded.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, we would be happy to go that direction, too. We were just trying to allow the local jurisdictions the ability to make that determination. We've been asked a lot of times, rather than the state telling all the local jurisdictions what they should or shouldn't do, that we just say, you know, the local jurisdiction gets to make that decision. So that's what we attempted to do in this bill.
Mr. Chair, but by your explanation, what's different? They make the jurisdiction now. They make the determination now. But by this bill, you're saying that if one can appear in uniform, the other can appear in uniform. Is that the distinction you're making in this bill?
The key distinction, Mr. Chair and Representative Berger, is line 6. The policy described in section shall apply to all persons in the department.
Exactly. So why not all persons in the department? Nobody can wear a uniform for any photograph or any use in a political venue.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I have no objection to that if you want to make that as an alternative to this bill.
That's not the bill before us. Yeah. This
Mr.
one.
Mr. DeLashman, I'm trying to tell you that I think this is petty and trivial, and I'm not going to support it.
Very good, Representative Berger. We always know where you stand. That's why I love you so much. Any further questions of these nice people? Representative Holvey.
Well, I guess to follow up on Representative Berger's question, I mean, the way I'm reading the bill, the local jurisdiction can decide whether or not they can, in fact, they could make a policy decision that says you can't wear uniforms across the board.
They could do that now.
But it needs to apply to all of them, and they could make a decision that you can, and it applies to all of them.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, that's the point.
And it's a good point. Any further discussion on this issue? Very good. Thank you. And would anyone else like to testify to House Bill 3406 today? All right. Oh, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3406, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3406 and entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3406 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Hovey moves House Bill 3406 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Kristen, would you please call over?
Aye.
Representative Berger.
No.
Vice
No.
Vice
Hovey.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Aye. Would anyone like to carry the volunteer to carry this bill on the floor? Representative Holby, thank you very much. I'm going to close the work session, House Bill 3406. Work session, House Bill 3432. Excuse me. The work session, public hearing, House Bill 3432.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3432 reduces the membership of the Board of Public Safety Standards and Training from 24 to 17 members and also changes the membership of the Corrections Policy Committee and the Fire Policy Committee, which is within the board structure. Committee members, in your staff measure summary, it contains a side-by-side comparison of the current membership of the board and the changes to the members that are proposed under the measure.
Thank you. Let's just go right down the line.
I'm going to bring you up in threes. Robert King, Brian DeLashman, Eric, and I'm sorry I can't read your last name, Eric. Is that a C or a G? Go G, okay. I heard that.
I
heard that.
Proceed.
For the record, Brian DeLashmet, representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations and the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees, as well as the Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers, and the Oregon State Police Officers Association. This bill, as you may or may not be aware of, because I've talked to many of you, is a priority bill of those associations. For a number of years, let me give you a little history. Going back approximately 8 years, it became apparent to those associations that the board had two particular problems. One is it was far too large. It's a 24-member board, and if you look at my testimony, and I'm not going to read through my testimony, but you can see a list of other boards that I'm familiar with on a regular basis. None of them exceed 12 to 13. I'm not aware of any other board in the state. There may be one. Maybe it's the Potato Commission board or something, but of the major boards, I'm not aware of any other board that exceeds those low teen numbers. So this board is 24 members. The second particular area of interest to my clients is that of the 24 members, many of those members are assigned a position on this board by virtue of the position that they hold rather than a particular expertise. For example, very straight example, that would be the director of DOC, the chief of the city of Portland, the Oregon director of the FBI, and not to say that those folks don't have value in this board, but there are specific positions on this board based upon a position rather than an expertise. And the last thing that became of particular concern was that the balance on this board, and if you understand the structure of this board also has three policy subcommittees. It has a policy subcommittee on police, it has a policy subcommittee on fire, and one on corrections. And then you also have memberships on those policy subcommittees. It became very apparent to us on issues of both training and on issues of certification or revocation of certifications that the balance was in fact causing some problems with not only the subcommittees but ultimately the board as far as the lack of information, the lack of what we consider to be due process in those revocations, and in many cases dealing with training issues, a lack of probably substantial and broad diverse input from those officers that are actually doing the tasks on the streets. So given that those three issues, what we've attempted to do since that issue came up is to figure out, is there some way in which we can reconfigure this board so it has additional input from those that essentially have the information based upon some expertise. They can be assigned by the Chiefs Association or the Firefighters Association or one of the police organizations. Based upon a number of factors, their area of expertise, it may be that we need a balance of rural and urban. And in doing so, what I attempted to do in having this bill drafted was accomplish a reduction in the size from 24 down to 17, at the same time trying to balance the area of expertise and also have a balance that more represents some balance and scale between those that are the actual worker bees versus those that are the managers. And so what we've done in this bill is, in fact, tried to accomplish those things. I have heard some discussion from some folks of, well, why did you delete the state fire marshal? Good question. If you don't delete some of those positions, then and you add to try and get balance and additional expertise, instead of having 24 members, we would have 38 members. So I took the risk of saying, okay, some of these folks on the full board may not have as much of a role as some of the other folks, and I took it upon myself, along with Representative Hunt in the drafting of this, to make some determinations as to those folks that would remain on. I am open to additional discussions about some folks being put back on, but the one thing that I want to very caution you is that on the current board and on the policy
side, Brian, we have to go to session.
I'll have to. I'll have
today,
one,
so
one more,
let's
one
wrap
more,
it.
One more session, or one more sentence, is we were very cognizant, if you add up the numbers of in the area of police, of sheriffs, and chiefs, and then you add up the number of the actual police officers. It was one police officer, and I think there was six or seven chiefs or sheriffs. And we didn't feel that balance was appropriate. And with that, I'll let Robert, as a board member...
We'll knock off at 4:15, don't you?
4:30.
For floor? We'll go right up to 4:30.
Okay.
Forgive me, gentlemen.
Then you have a little bit longer, no?
I will not take my Ralph Groner exception.
Okay.
I'll shut up now.
Chair Schaffler, members of the committee, my name is Robert King. I'm a 19-year police officer in the state of Oregon for the last 6 years. I've been the full-time elected president of the Portland Police Association. I represent 930 police officers, sergeants, detectives, and criminalists. I'm also a member of the OCPA, which represents 4,700 public safety workers. I have represented literally hundreds of officers through the investigative and the due process and the arbitration process. And I'm here today to ask for your support for House Bill 3432. I am currently a member of the DPSST board. My title on that board is a non-management representative. I'm here to ask for your help. The board, I believe, needs to be reconstituted. One of the central administrative functions of the board, of the DPSST board, is to review police officer conduct for possible decertification. And in that arena, the board is part of what I see as a biased process that provides no meaningful due process and no impartial investigations, and it has not resulted in unbiased judgments. I'm here to talk to you mostly today about process. I know as this issue arises and as officer conduct arises that there are, of course, facts and specific cases that you and I are both aware of that disturbs us. I'm not here to discuss specific facts, but rather to talk to you about the inequity that exists in the structure of the board and the process that they follow, because really, due process is our concern, and today we don't believe that there is a chance at due process. As you know, DPSST has a statutory and a regulatory authority. In Oregon, in order to exercise authority as a police officer, an individual must be licensed by Oregon's DPSST. DPSST exists and operates according to ORS 181651. They exist and operate also according to 181630. The legislature has given DPSST authority to establish by rule reasonable minimum standards for physical, emotional, intellectual, and moral fitness of public safety personnel and instructors, and to deny, to suspend, and to revoke certifications based on these minimum standards. They set forth in legislative guidelines how they may deny or how they may revoke certifications. And according to statute, certification may be denied or revoked based upon a finding that a public safety officer has provided false information on an application, which we, of course, don't agree with or don't disagree with. The public safety officer has been convicted of a crime. We think it's appropriate decertification occurs in these cases. A public safety officer does not meet minimum standards of physical, emotional, intellectual, and moral fitness for public safety personnel as established by DPSST, and therein lies a large part of our concern. Essentially, what happens for us is we participate in and we are a part of an employer-dominated board. Whenever there's information that's provided to DPSST through any means, or there is a just cause termination, the entire matter goes to the Police Policy Committee. The Policy Committee itself is composed predominantly of sheriffs and chiefs. And when the Policy Committee evaluates the information that's in front of them about, for example, moral fitness, the individual officer, him or herself, is prohibited from playing any meaningful role in the process. They are only able to submit written documentation to the Policy Committee. So it would be similar, I think, today to submitting the material that I have for you in writing and being prohibited from providing you with any sort of statement that gives you any sort of insight or perspective or any kind of context into the action that the officer was engaged in. The Policy Committee, in the overwhelming majority of cases, recommends to the full DPSST board decertification. And when that happens, it takes two-thirds of the full DPSST board to overturn the Policy Committee recommendation. Now, the real problem that we face, the real concern I have, is that in Oregon, in collective bargaining agreements, officers, when they're fired, they have the ability, through the grievance procedure, to go to binding arbitration. And one of the things that has happened at DPSST is that officers who have been fired by their employers and who have been brought back to work by independent, neutral, third-party arbitrators who have evaluated these cases, the DPSST board, the policy committee, they take no judicial notice whatsoever of those decisions. So you can be fired, you can be reinstated, And nevertheless, the policy committee will recommend decertification, and in fact, the full board will in fact move to decertification. And it's not until much later in the process that the individual affected officer has the opportunity to appear publicly and say anything at all about their action or their conduct. So I, like you, am concerned with officer misconduct. In our association, there are officers who bring cases to us that are so egregious that we do not carry those cases forward to arbitration. We take officer professionalism and the service to the community very seriously. But the current structure of the board and the processes available to us today creates a real and inherent unfairness to us. It undermines and eliminates our collective bargaining rights, and that's wrong. So what I'm hoping you'll agree with is that one of the steps that we can take to rectify this is a change in this board structure. You know, in our country, in our system of law, we will let 10 guilty people go to protect one innocent person. And what this structure and rules amount to is for an employer, two bites at the apple. And for the people who put their lives on the line every day on the street and who have a process that they rely on to protect them, they deserve better protection, I think, than this. So please, I would ask that you would support this bill for the reconstitution of this board as a step in a process that we hope will create a greater degree of fairness for Portland's, for Oregon's public safety officers. Thank you.
Chair, go ahead.
Thank you. Chair Schaffler, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Eric Gablis. I'm the Deputy Director at the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, where's our better known DPSST. My comments will be short today. I have given you written testimony. What I want to do is do two things. For starters, we are neutral on the bill, as is the board, but we wanted to share with you information on how the board has gotten to this size and also how the board works. The board started originally serving 5,000 police officers in 1961. Then over the years, you could see we've grown to serve 35,000 people from not only law enforcement, but also fire, corrections, prone probation, 911, emergency medical dispatch, private security, and private investigators. And the board is really a vehicle that is used to administer the regulatory process as well as the advisory process to the agency. And you see that light out there in front of you. The other handouts that I've given you in the green color really shows how the board operates. The board, as been mentioned, is 24 members, but the policy committees are all in statute. And those policy committees are really where the bulk of the work is done. And then each of those policy committees has advisory committees or subcommittees that are formed to really address issues as they come up. And then the corrections, or the, I'm sorry, the different advisory committees make the recommendation to the board, and then the board takes action from that. And that's really how the organization works. And I know your time is short, so we just wanted to give you that information to get it on the record so you understand how it works, and I could answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you. We're not going to take questions. We're going to hear all this testimony today. We're not going to work this bill today. And I would say the proponents work with the opponents. Let's try and find a balance, and I'm going to hear from some people now that are neutral, opposed, then I'm going to hear from people that are neutral, then I'm going to finish with some upper opponent. So, folks, just write your questions down. I want to get everybody to testify on this bill today. We will not be working it today. We will bring it back, and then we'll have a question opportunity. I would like to call State Fire Marshal, State Fire Marshal Office, Terry Glocar. And Donna Dish, please. I hope I'm reading that correctly. These folks are neutral. Whenever you're ready, ladies.
Okay. Thank you. Chair Schaffler, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Terry Glocker, and I'm here today representing Nancy Orr, State Fire Marshal. You have in front of you some testimony that we are submitting on behalf of the State Fire Marshal's office. We are neutral on this bill. On the reverse of the testimony is some information I'd like to call your attention to. I have just a couple of points I want to make today. I'm not going to go through the details of her testimony. I'm sure you can read that. The first thing I want to talk about is that the board has the approval authority for 50-plus fire professional certificates, and that's the list that is on the reverse side of your testimony. And they all directly and indirectly interface with the State Fire Marshal's mission, goals, statutory authority, and obligations. And so that's a real important issue for us in terms of our position with the State Fire Marshal on the DPSST Advisory Board and the Policy Committee. There are significant complications for the State Farm Marshal's office if the board and policy committee levels are removed from the State Farm Marshal's ability to be on there. The committee levels is where we have that ability to work with DPSST to forward a common vision for the fire service, and where we work to put our mission and our goals together with what DPSST Advisory Board does. We work with them on strategic planning for the fire service and building that expertise that the State Farm Marshal lends to the DPSST Advisory Board and the Fire Policy Committee. The other thing that we share is a common funding source. I'm sure you're all familiar with fire insurance premium tax dollars, and that comes into the State Farm Marshal's office and then is flowed through to DPSST Advisory Board for fire training and certification. That's where we like to work with DPSST Advisory Board to align our common goals and missions for the fire service in Oregon. That's all I have for you today. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer those.
Thank you for your efficient testimony. Please.
And I'm Donna Dish with the Office of State Fire Marshal, and Chair Schaffler and members of the committee. I'd like to mention that out of the 35,000 members of public safety in the state of Oregon, 11,000 of those are in fire service. And out of those 11,000, about 80% are volunteers. The hub that the State Fire Marshal makes for the Oregon Fire Service is very, very critical. And keeping that hub intact is very important. And I know that our members of the fire service feel strongly about this. And that's all I have for you.
Thank you very much. And I appreciate it. I apologize for making this go so fast to everyone. But I want to get all the information on it. And then we will open back up for questions later. So thank you very much. I'm going to call Pat Schreiner, Jenna Ingram, and Ken Armstrong, please. And whoever sits down first can go right ahead and start.
All right, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I'm Ken Armstrong, representing the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association. You know, I don't pretend to be as much of an expert as some people in the room on the board of DPSST. It certainly appears to me, listening to the testimony from the proponents of the bill, that there are some pretty significant issues that are of concern to them and that they're trying to reach some resolution of. Doesn't seem to me that by adding a member here, taking a member off there, it's going to resolve some of those problems. You know, do we have a problem with increasing labor representation on the board? Not really. Our concern is primarily those people who are being slated for removal, specifically the fire marshal, Portland fire chief. I think there are ways you can probably fix this one way or the other. If you're trying to reach a, you know, an arbitrary set number of people, feeling like above that's too many, below that's not enough, I don't know. But it does sound like there are some pretty fundamental problems that need to be discussed that aren't going to be resolved by increasing the member here or taking someone off. So I don't really have an answer for you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. We would like to be part of the discussion on it, and that's what we've got to offer for you.
Thank you. General, go ahead.
Chair Schaffler, members of the committee, Jenna Ingram, Executive Director of the Oregon Fire District Directors Association. We do oppose the bill, primarily for the reasons the individuals who are coming off. Primarily, first on that list of concern would be the Oregon State Fire Marshal's representative, because the Fire Marshal is responsible for overseeing the training and certification of fire officials throughout the state, and we think it's important that that agency have a representative there. We're also very concerned that the representative from the State Department of the Department of Forestry, just due to the obviously the problems that go on, the fires, and the coordination needs to go on there, and we think that they deserve a place at the table to be heard. From what I've heard just this afternoon on this bill, is it seems to be moving toward maybe a management labor issue, and I would hope that DPSST would not be seen as a clearinghouse for those issues. We believe that there are other avenues that are appropriate to hear those issues, and we would like to keep the focus on public safety. We understand that there are issues. I'm sure the chair would argue that there are management and labor issues that do affect public safety, but we feel that there are other avenues that are more appropriate to deal with those. As you know, management and labor issues can be extremely contentious, and we would like to, wherever possible, keep that out of the DPSST process. And that concludes my testimony.
Thank you. Sir, go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Pat Schreiner. I'm a district manager with Multnomah County Department of Community Justice, and I'm testifying here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors. We are also opposed to the proposed amendments in House Bill 3432. We believe our association has a history of working collaboratively with labor and with our criminal justice partners to improve public safety. Currently, our association is the only discipline that's not represented on the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training Board of Directors. But we're opposed to this amendment because we do not believe the system is broken. This system is currently working for us. We are represented with one seat on the Corrections Policy Committee. And, you know, we have talked before about it would be nice to have more representation. But, however, we are finding that one seat on the Corrections Policy Committee is where the work gets done relative to our association and our profession, and the work is getting done. We are very pleased with that collaborative effort and the work that we're getting done to improve not only the certification, the training, and the professionalism of the field of parole and probation. The state and the counties expect managers of public safety operations to direct the activities of a department. These duties include determining the level of service, methods of operation, and staffing. We do this work in collaboration with our bargaining units. So we have a few questions about this. I mean, would these changes result in ultimately how we train and certify officers? That concerns us. The responsibility to properly train and discharge duties as provided by DPSST is held by the employing public safety agencies and should be reflected in the board's membership. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. And, folks, I'm going to tell you just the same thing I told everybody else. I think you can solve this problem among yourselves. There's two parties here. One party's not happy, and they want some. They feel it's out of balance. I'm sympathetic to that. That's no surprise to anyone here. If people want to resolve this problem, they can. And I'm asking you to go talk to the proponents of this bill to bring us back a solution to get as many people up here, hopefully all of us, to yes. I'm confident you all can do that. So that's my charge to you. And we'll open another public hearing up, so we will have question and answer, I promise everyone here. And I want to thank you for your efforts today. And I'm going to finish this up today with Bob Livingston, please. Bob, whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Bob Livingston, representing the Oregon State Firefighters Council. And I think I can hopefully provide a couple of unique perspectives. One, as a former board member for 6 years, you can serve for a total of 6 years. And during that time, I also was the chair of the Fire Policy Committee. And there are some fundamental problems. And I do want to put on the record that, you know, I do take it a little bit offensive that people are characterizing this bill as a labor management issue. Fact of the matter is as a board member and as somebody that represented firefighters, I took a duty and a responsibility as somebody that was appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate to not only address issues for the people that I represent, but ultimately, particularly as a chair, to make sure that I'm establishing policy with respect to certification standards and training. And I think regardless of whether you're someone that represents labor or someone that represents management, everyone took that responsibility with the utmost of concern. So what you have heard today, though, is there's a fundamental problem. When you have 20-plus people that are trying to establish policies for the state of Oregon with respect to training, with respect to certifications and standards, it becomes unwieldy. Could you imagine this committee having 22 members on it, coming from diverse backgrounds, trying to establish and set policy? The problem is it's gotten to be dysfunctional. Now, having said that, there has been some improvements that have been made over the years. One of the best improvements that took place was when they separated out the policy committees. But once again, the problem that we face with the policy committees, while that's where you vet and do a bunch of the work and then make recommendations to the full board, you need to consider the rebalancing of those. Those aren't labor management issues that we discuss in there. But if you're going to have an appropriate perspective from all walks of life, you need to seriously consider looking at the makeup of those. I would argue that clearly many of the local employer folks have no problem organizing how they carry business in this building with respect to communications and strategies and communicating interest. Clearly, I believe they could probably do the same. And so by the fact that I think you need to reduce the numbers, you seriously need to consider reducing that. And I guess I would just like to close in the essence of time of giving you my personal experience, particularly, and I really agree with Mr. King, with respect to certifications and standards. Probably one of the most important jobs that I took was when you had to deal with protecting the interest of the public versus the revocation, denial, or suspension of an individual certification. Clearly, when you do that, that's a life-changing and arguably a career-ending decision for a public safety officer. My frustration that I had as a full board member was there were times when I had written testimony that even came from the employers that said, we really want to hold on to this individual. We think they're a good employee. However, we're forced to take this to this level. I was not able to ask questions. I was not able to delve into that. The decision had already been made before it came to the full board. I was uncomfortable with that in many instances, and I would encourage you, and I'm proud of the record and position that I took. A majority of the time, absolutely, it was no question. As Mr. King alluded to, many of these, when it came to crimes, when it came to things that were obvious, those people, you know, lost their certification. There was many instances where the goose was cooked before my responsibility as a full board member, somebody charged with setting policy, revocation, and denial, my hands were tied based on the process. And so that's one of the concerns I have. And finally, one of the last things just to also clarify is that we have different levels of certification and standards. For example, police standards are codified in law through standards that then are promulgated by DPSST. As an example, on the fire service, all of the standards that DPSST recommends are advisory only. They're not binding in the state of Oregon. The only standards that you have with respect to the fire service have to do with OSHA laws for basic firefighter and for hazardous materials certifications. Everything else that the fire policy committee does is advisory only to the local jurisdiction. So clearly, there's some differences in even the policies that are established. And so I would encourage you folks to hopefully we will work with the some of the folks that oppose this bill, but the system's broken and it needs to be fixed, Mr. Chair, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
I agree with you, Mr. Livingston. I do. We'll ask you, as I ask the rest, reach out, spread the joy. Common ground makes for common sense, and I'm confident we can solve this problem, but I hope we all come together with a solution. That would be best. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, would you indulge me with a few minutes of comment here just so that the...
Actually, I'll give you a minute and a half.
As these folks go forward, I think they need to hear from us as to what we're thinking about this.
Absolutely.
And it seems to me that what you have is a process problem that is in some way centered around the structure of this board and the working of this board. And really, it seems to me from the testimony that we had today, it's the certification issue that is the heart of the matter. Now, we heard from the gentleman from the DPSST that this whole structure is statutory. Most boards aren't that statutory in their structure. In other words, the whole, not only the top tier, but the lower tiers are. And I would suggest to you that the proposed solution, just making the board smaller or some other configuration, this is a bigger problem than that. And this is very serious business, unlike the other things. So I think you need to put your heads together and say, how can we structure and come to terms with this board that satisfies not only our need? If you have this many sub-people, you need a lot of people on the board. Otherwise, everybody's doing all the work. But you also need to have a structure around certification where everyone feels that they're part of the process. And if you noodle on it, I think you can get there.
I believe you're right. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3432. Thank you all. Just for the record, the chair supports House Bill 3061. I apologize to those who came to testify today. We will be carrying it over to Friday. But I just wanted to let you all know that. I apologize to you. So we're running out of time. Oh, where's your...
Thank you.